Well, good evening to everybody. Thank you for coming back to join with us in our time of worship again this evening. And I'm always appreciative of the time that I have to be able to share part of God's Word with you together. What I want to share with you guys this evening is two possible ways that I could call this. One is, how do you see beyond? Or, in a maybe a more conventional way to say it, no pain, no gain. And we'll get to this, as I think you'll understand, and this is a concept that we're very familiar with, but unfortunately I think is, as we strive to either apply it to spiritual things or as the world around us would like to believe, sometimes we may not see the basic simple things around wisdom like this, and so that's why I wanted to take a moment around it. Because there is a purpose behind it, and there's a whole bunch of other things that come along with it that we'll be able to see from God's Word. But if you're wanting to see beyond something, you can look at circumstances in front of you, and you can either see it oftentimes for the mess that it is, or you can realize that there's some potential, some possibility, some other outcome that lays on the other side, just beyond it. It takes maturity to be able to see beyond current circumstances to something else that is possible. And that's an acquired capability that we learn and grow into over time. As young children, they don't often see that. As I will tell you from raising my own daughters, that was an attribute that I had to ultimately be able to teach them, was how to see beyond current circumstances onto something else that was desirable. And so as you think about this, and I've put up two contrasts on purpose, because the physical things are sometimes easy to relate to, but it's the spiritual things that oftentimes we'd like to say, well, can I just skip through the story and just read the closing page and get to the end? And life doesn't work like that. And life didn't work like that for Jesus, as we'll see in a moment either. And that had a purpose and a motivation and a reason for that being in place that we'll see. But if I had to look where I want to be on the other side of a few things, right? That's the things on the physical side. I want to be able to see beyond what does it take to lose 10 pounds. And I'll tell you, that's not an easy thing to do. Right? Or I want to be able to live a healthier lifestyle, lower my stress, eat better. Not an easy thing to do. Or I want to be able to take time off, enjoy some relaxation, some time with Janet, enjoy the area, be able to just de-stress and decompress. But I also know what that's going to take and all the work that is going to be required to be able to carve off that amount of time. Or if I want to turn to something maybe a little bit more serious, right? Daughters are 23 and 20, and how do I make sure that my daughters lead successful, healthy, independent lives? None of those things come naturally. None of them come easily either. But now let's look at the other side, some spiritual life-related things. I want to be able to overcome trials, and successfully. I want to be able to learn and use and apply patience. Not an easy quality. I want to be able to trust in the things and the promises that God has given us, especially in an era of time where you see many people doubting what trust is in God, let alone God Himself. Or you want to just jump all this up and you want to be able to see a promised land. Nathan talked about that with us this morning, with Abraham. And I would, even though I don't know if Nathan would have said it in these words, I'll say it like this. Abraham had to be able to see beyond the present circumstances to something else. Otherwise, there's no motivation to do what he did. And I think you see that played out in his life, how he prioritized and chose to do things. Now, as you take this, just a few things that come to mind that I think are obvious, but we're going to go through them, and we'll see how they apply and they bear out through Scripture. is, one, the basic principle of suffering and sacrifice. Athletes go through this all the time. As a matter of fact, I was discussing this with our Vice President of Services earlier in the year, as he and his family were looking to do some interesting goal setting for themselves through the year, and he said, my son has set a goal around, I want to do 10,000 of something, of 10,000 of 10 things. Right? And so one of them was, I want to be healthier, so therefore I'm going to do 10,000 push-ups. Well, how do you get healthier doing 10,000 push-ups? Well, you don't do it all at one shot. That's for sure. Your arms will fall off, or you keel over from a heart attack, something, whatever it is. But if you have a goal and a plan, and you know that it takes a long journey or a high invested amount of effort, you set yourself on the path and the purpose, realizing it'll take many things in order to get there. So how do you break down 10,000 push-ups in a year? Is as you look at it in 300 days, and you say, well, then I need to do about 33 or 35 push-ups a day. Now all of a sudden that big problem becomes practical. That's one way that you can accomplish. But that's going to take dedication, some suffering, and some sacrifice, because you're also going to have to take something away from something else in order to accomplish or achieve that goal. Some sacrifice is involved. Now, that's a trivial example, but I want you to be able to wrap your brain around the concept. The other thing to recognize is it's a natural part of the process. That's why I said an alternate title of this lesson could be No Pain, No Gain. We understand that. We know that if you want to achieve, say, a career aspiration, it might require formal education. Or it might require dedication towards understudy or skill development or something that requires you to take time away from something else in order to achieve that goal. We get that as a concept. We understand that. And so that means that we have to have a mind to commit enough, knowing where we desire to be, but also without knowing all the details. Right? So, for example, would an athlete know that in doing 10,000 of something, right, of, let's say, for example, might set of Michael Jordan, for him to have as good of a game as he had, he committed himself to doing 10,000 shots a year. That's where that figure comes from, by the way. For you to really be expert and proficient at something, it's the rule of 10,000. Learned that this year, by the way. And so if you're going to invest yourself in that, you don't get caught up in all the details of, oh, I have to be at the gym at 6 in the morning, and I have to work at it for an hour and a half in order to know that I'll be able to be the highest performing player in the NBA. You don't necessarily involve yourself with all the details before you make your commitment. You just know that your commitment is towards this goal. And then the details that come along are something that we have to deal with, manage, absorb, adapt to. Okay, and we'll see how this plays itself out in the life of suffering, especially as it relates to what I put as a contrast between rational suffering and irrational suffering. Because as Jesus is going to show us here in a moment, this is all to be expected. So in Matthew, the 10th chapter, 25 through 28, and if you want to follow along, I'm going to put the scriptures up here. But in the 25th verse, he tells them, is it enough for the disciple that he be as his master and the servant as his Lord? If they have called the master of the house of Beelzebub, how much more shall they call them of his household? Now, in the midst of all this, Jesus is teaching them a point about how he himself is criticized. But taking that criticism of how he is dealing with it, right? He is the one being called effectively of the house of Satan because of the things that he said. But he uses that as an extension to also say, how much more are the people, the members of the household of that master, going to be treated like the same? As a matter of fact, you could go so far as to say, and I think we know this intuitively, if they treat the leader this poorly, how well or how poorly, much more poorly, are they going to treat the servants? It's a natural relationship. So he pointed this out to them early, and by extension to his disciples, he's pointing it out to us as well. Because if there's people that speak evilly of Jesus, what are they going to say about us? Natural extension. And so Peter says this in 1 Peter, the second chapter, 21, "For even hereunto you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps." Now wait a second. We get the "he was called because Christ also suffered for us." But do you see the extension for what he's saying of the steps that we are to follow in? We are to follow in his steps of suffering, is what Peter is telling them. And so none of this should come as a surprise. But likewise, this shouldn't feel as if it is so extraordinary in life, as if to achieve a goal, there isn't some suffering and sacrifice that comes with achieving the goal. But I will say from personal experience, of course, the form that it comes can be quite extraordinarily challenging. I'll give you that. But the fact that there's suffering and sacrifice that comes with a Christian life should not be a surprise. It is a natural part of the territory. Why? Because the Master himself had to endure these things. And so it gets into perils and costs. As Jesus was telling his disciples in using a few examples in Luke, the 14th chapter, I realize this is a little small, so if you actually want to follow along on this one, might be easier to read yourselves, but Luke, the 14th chapter, beginning in verse 26, he really elaborates on this principle and uses a few examples, but he starts off by being very assertive with them about what this meant as a cost of discipleship. He tells them, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brother and sister, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple, and whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my disciple." Now, I think we understand, naturally speaking, about the emphasis that Jesus is making. And really, this is a statement around hyperbole, not as if it's an unrealistic outcome. Are there people that I have seen, heard, or know about that have had to, in some form, cut themselves off from their family in order to pursue Jesus? Yes, it has happened. Is it that common in our society nowadays? Not that common, but it does happen. But we do understand that hyperbolic contrast that he's creating. He is saying, your commitment to me as my disciple has to be so far and above any other personal relationship you have, as if to say, I hate that thing in order to pursue my goal. But then he goes on even a little bit further, and I emphasize the "does not carry their cross" part on purpose, because for us, where we wear crosses around our necks, you know, as a society, is a symbology of our allegiance, usually towards Jesus, is what you find people doing that to do. But for somebody to say they are going to carry their cross in the first century meant to say, I identify with death row convicts. That's what that meant to first century people. And so in order to say, I am going to carry my cross daily, means I am going so far as to not only forsake any relationship, but I might also become publicly humiliated by virtue of what I'm doing. Because that is what Jesus being hung on the cross was intended to do in the first century. So we really need to understand that amplification. But then he goes on further, and he really tries to reiterate for them the principles behind this. And this is the peril and the cost part of it. Going on in 28, he says, "Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Won't you first sit down and estimate the cost to see if you have enough money to complete it? For if you lay the foundation and are not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule you, saying, this person began to build and wasn't able to finish it." Now I'll tell you, this played out in where we were before in Austin, Texas, many years ago, in the face of the dot-com bust after 2000. And there were a number of companies, being a high-tech headquarters for many many corporations throughout America, that were experiencing dramatic growth and prospects ahead. But then all of a sudden the world financially came to an end for them at, right after 2000, and unfortunately there were a number of literal skeleton frames with foundations laid with nothing more than beams sticking out of the ground for at least five or six construction projects that they could no longer finish. Because to them, they had not envisioned a world that would involve their business evaporating. They did not properly count the costs. But Jesus is telling them, look, you just heard me say about what it means to become a disciple. And you know it's a ridicule that if somebody invests in building a building and doesn't finish it because they just didn't seem to have the foresight to know what it would mean to complete it, that it's even worse than if you just didn't build. It's a ridicule. It's an artifact left there for everybody to point to as that personal failure. So he's amplifying this commitment going a little bit further. Or he says in verse 31, or suppose a king is about to go to war against another king. Won't he first sit down and consider whether he is able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? If he is not able, he will send a delegation while the other is still a long way off and ask for terms of peace. In the same way, those of you who do not give up everything you have cannot be my disciples. And he doesn't just tell them, you know, it's going to be a hard road, or you're going to be conflicted, or you're going to have extra trials and suffering. No, he tells them, if you cannot give up everything, if you're not going to have that committed mind, you cannot be my disciple. It's excluded from. Why? Well, that's where we'll go through and we'll see some things. But if you cannot commit yourself to want to go through the suffering, just coming back to those physical personal examples, if, and Jay and I were talking about this earlier today, right? I've completely gotten out of my exercise routine for the last 2 years. And my normal habit would have been I'd go exercise in the middle of the day. I am not a morning person. But because of the way my current work life is going, exercising in the middle of the day is next to impossible. That's why I'm off my routine. So she and I know that for me to achieve that goal, I now have to exercise in the morning. I am going against the grain of me not being a morning person. It was ironic, right, that this was the subject she and I were talking about in the car this afternoon. And I said, I'll go do this with you, because she's a morning person, or she can be. I'll go do this with you, but don't expect me to be happy. Right? That's my proviso on it. I'll do it, but I might be grumpy. But see, I know what that means for me to get in and commit towards being healthier and possibly getting to the point where I can lose that 10 pounds. It's going to take something extraordinary for me. I know it may sound trivial for you. Extraordinary for me. And if I'm not committed to it, I'm just better off not starting. Because then I'm going to have a gym membership for a year, and I'm going to pay that, and I'm just going to hate myself every time that month comes around, and I'm not using that thing all over again. So anyway, I use that as a trivial example to get us back to these things that Jesus is saying. But we have to understand, what does it mean to commit to Jesus? Well, going a little bit further, one thing, and I had patience up there, is recognizing that as we see things happening to us, to other Christians, to the world around us, justice is not always met on our time frame or our horizon. So this is kind of just a little bit of a supporting element as we go into this endeavor to understand our mindset, what does it take to achieve it, because this is an excerpt that John recorded in this heavenly scene that he was caught up in for Revelation in 6th chapter, beginning in verse 9, where he tells them what he saw. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and the testimony that they had maintained. They called out in a loud voice, "How long, sovereign Lord, holy and true, until you judge the inhabitants of the earth and avenge our blood?" Then each of them was given a white robe, and they were told to wait a little longer until the full number of their fellow servants, their brothers and sisters, were killed just as they had been. Isn't that an odd thing, especially by world standards, to be told to those that had gone through and made the maximum sacrifice somebody can make in this life, which is sacrificing your own life? And here they are, as John records, the souls at the altar at the feet of the Lord Himself, crying out for justice. And the response is, here's your white robe, you've gotten your reward, and be patient a little bit longer. And life is going to ask that of us a lot as Christians. We just have to recognize that not everything is going to get sorted out in our timeline, in our horizon. And it may not even happen in our life, and we may be one of these that is told to wait a little longer. And we need to be okay with that. Because God, holding all things, will make sure it's all taken care of in His time. So we have to have patience to see it through for what we have before us in His way. Now, I mentioned a moment ago, we understand suffering, but I think we also understand it in two different ways. And I call it rational versus irrational suffering. We understand the rational suffering. We understand the things that we suffer for because we ourselves put ourselves there to suffer it. Right? For example, for me to get healthier, I'm going to suffer exercising at 6 in the morning. I said that on purpose. I will suffer through it. It's not going to be fun, especially in the beginning. That, to a certain degree, is rational suffering. Somebody that does something in their life that has dire consequences will suffer rationally for the consequences of what they've done. You get it. You don't enjoy it. You don't want it. You wish you could put it off, but you know it. But what Peter says here in 1 Peter the second chapter is also telling us there is going to be some irrational suffering. Suffering that has no logical basis whatsoever. It has no roots in justice. It has no roots in fairness. It has no roots in you getting what you deserve by you putting yourself in a particular place on purpose. In beginning in verse 20, he says, "But how is it to your credit if you receive a beating for doing wrong and endure it?" That's the rational suffering. If you do wrong and you get a beating, you know it. No questions asked. But he tells them, "But if you suffer for doing good and you endure it, this is commendable before God." Irrational suffering is something that is intrinsically part of the Christian calling. Jesus had to do this himself. None of the suffering he endured had any basis in rationality at all. Because did he stand blamed before anybody? Nobody had anything on Jesus. But yet, he did anyway. From our eyes, it's an irrational basis for that suffering. And so when it comes to discipline and chastisement, we understand this, but as the Hebrew writer tells those in Hebrews the 12th chapter, beginning in verse 5, when he is describing discipline and chastisement as it comes from the Lord, he says, "And have you completely forgotten His word of encouragement that addresses you as a father addresses his sons?" It says, "My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline, and do not lose heart when He rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines the one He loves, and He chastens everyone He accepts as His son." Tying it back for a moment, for me to see my daughters become productive, spiritual, independent young ladies required some chastisement along the way. I can tell you, for me to arrive, even at my imperfect state I am now, took a lot of chastisement, a lot of discipline. And you have to realize that that discipline is there for a purpose to our benefit. There is a rational basis for that suffering that comes from that. And if we understand that, and that God loves us because of that, then we can endure it with faith and willfully receive the outcome that it has. Which he says in verse 7, "Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as His children. For what children are not disciplined by their father? If you are not disciplined and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are not legitimate, not true sons and daughters at all. Get that? If you have no discipline in your life, that means the one that is supposedly having that relationship with you does not care. They just do not care. And so for us to endure hardship and discipline and suffering in our lives spiritually does have roots in God caring for us. And if we don't, that would say that God does not care about us because he's letting you go off in your own direction. Key point. Moreover, we have all had human fathers who disciplined us and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of spirits and live? They disciplined us for a little while that they thought best, but God disciplines us for our good in order that we may share in his holiness. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. How is it that Michael Jordan can achieve the top of his game? Because he was willing to discipline himself to do 10,000 shots a year of practice, of things that didn't matter, that didn't count in a real game. But why is he able, or did he have the mind to do that? Is a spiritual analog that you see here. It produced a harvest of righteousness and peace for those that had been trained by it. Because the outcome is better than the process of disciplining that it takes to achieve it. That's the same mind that we have to have in recognizing discipline from our Father. So it all comes down to our attitude, which is really what James tells us at the beginning of James 1. We've referenced this some in our classes recently. Consider it all joy. Get that? All joy, as he opens this, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds. Now that's not conventional wisdom, is it? Especially for our day and age, where joy is about amusement. You count it all joy when I can have endless amounts of amusement and liberty to do whatever I want. That's the world's definition of all joy. James' definition, as he tells us through the Spirit, is facing trials of many kinds because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. Why is this joyful? Or even more, all joy, the totality of joyfulness, is because of the outcome. But we have to have that attitude to find the joy in it. Because if you don't, right, this is what I often would tell my young engineers as we would go through this thing, they would come in and they would grouse about all these problems on the production floor or other things like that, and they would got tired of me saying it after a while, right? What's a problem but an opportunity to excel? They got tired of me saying that. But I also got tired of listening to them grouse about the problems on the production floors, and I'd look at them sometimes and I'd just flatly say, you do realize those problems are why you have a job. No problems, no job, right? It's a flip with a little bit harsher way of saying the same thing. But let's take that and apply it spiritually for just a moment, though. To be a Christian, to want to productively reach our goal, will require wanting to have an attitude to overcome these things. Is it going to be a very joyful outcome if we're just grousing about everything that happens in life as we get there? Not only is it not going to be very enjoyable, but and you're going to make other people around you miserable. But I would advocate to you that you're probably not going to see it through, because after a while, that mindset of just grousing and complaining and why do I have to deal with this and everything else results really in you convincing yourself of one thing. Why bother? You will talk yourself out of the journey if you don't do this. And we know that. I know, for example, if I want to concentrate in the next year about having to get up at 6 a.m. three times a week to go work out, if I just focus on that one thing, and I complain and I grouse about it all year long, about a month into this, I'm going to stop. We know this. So why is spiritual life any different? Paul knew this in talking about what he called his thorn in the flesh. 2 Corinthians 12, beginning in verse 7, he says, "Therefore, in order to keep me from becoming conceited, I was given a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me." Interesting way he looked at that. In order to avoid me becoming conceited, he knew a little bit about his weaknesses as well. Good thing, right? You should reflect on that. But he also says he got a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. Three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness." And haven't we seen that happen throughout all of the things that we see recorded for us about God working with his people? He uses the least in order to amplify his power, and in the process, the least become glorified just as the Father is glorified. If we can step back long enough to recognize the power of weakness, we can actually enjoy some pretty cool things. But that means you got to allow yourself to be weak, to suffer, to be afflicted, to deal with some problems. But then he says, go on further, "Therefore I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong." How can those two things be at the same time? Because one, for Paul to be weak in the flesh means that he's strong in the spirit. So he's drawing contrast between physical and spiritual things and a truth that comes from it. But going on further, he tells the Philippian brethren towards the end of his life in 4th chapter beginning in verse 11, "I am not saying this because I am in need, for I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances." Wise man. He'd been through a lot. He recounted them for the disciples at one point, all of the hardships and trials that he'd been through. He'd been through a lot. "I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret." Get that? Learn the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. What is his secret? "I can do all this through him who gives me strength. Yet it was good of you to share in my troubles." Now, a lot of times people will focus on that last part. "I can do all this," or in some translations, "I can do all things through him who strengthens me," right? Is another rendering of this. "I can do all this through him who gives me strength." But do we recognize all the lack and want and hardship that Paul had at the same time in speaking this as the secret for how it was that he found to have a productive and useful and positive and purposeful life? He contrasts this not with wanting to just have good things, but recognizing how to be content even in the midst of some hardship. And for him, that meant a lot of hardship. What does that mean for us? And of course, we have Jesus, the ultimate example of all of this, and I'm just going to pull out two references here of many that we can look at. But as Paul tells us about Jesus in Philippians, the second chapter, verse 8, talking about him, he said, "In being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father." Why did Jesus humble himself to the point of obedience to death? Is for all the things that he knew followed after. Not as if he was seeking personal glory. Can some people get absorbed in the outcome for personal glory? Yes. And I think we see this. Your truth radar goes off in about a nanosecond when you find people around us. And we know, based on what's recorded for us about Jesus, he is not that. Because he had to humble himself to the point of obedience to death. not just as a person, but as God. Submitting yourself to your creation to the ultimate abuse of being murdered wrongfully. Think about that for a moment. So all the things that follow are a direct outcome of his mindset and his attitude as he goes into this. Or as it said in Hebrews, the 12th chapter, it says, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, talking about in chapter 11, that great hall of faith, but then he uses Jesus here in a moment to amplify this. Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Doing what? Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. So why do you fix your eyes on Jesus? Because he's the trailblazer. He's the one that's gone there, that's done this. It allows us to put our eyes on a point somewhere in the distance and look beyond. Now you get the hint of why I titled this the way I did at the beginning. See beyond what's now to what is to come. Marathon runners do this all the time. Now, as much as I might desire to run a marathon, I'll tell you, I know my limitations. I will never run a marathon. But I hear this about marathoners routinely. They put their focus, especially about the midpoint of a race, on something way out ahead of them. Why? Because you got to distract your mind off of what's going on right now. You got to focus yourself on something to remind you about what your goal is. And for us as Christian, what's a better way to remind ourselves of our goal than Jesus himself? Both the pioneer, the trailblazer, but also the perfecter. The one that made us understand, to see, to feel, to touch, to have a role model of what faith means. That's what we have by the example of Jesus. So that we do not grow weary and lose heart. And so then in this, we have to be able to see the end of things. As he says, 1 Peter 1, verse 6, in all this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. These have come so that the proven genuineness of your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. Pause on that for a moment, right? He's using the metaphor of refining gold. And how is gold refined? And if you've ever watched the History Channel or something like this that shows you about metallurgical refinement, even iron or whatever it is, you heat something up so that all the impurities come to the top. And they slag it off, they'll scrape it off, and then what's left underneath is the pure stuff. But what Peter's pointing out here is really drawing our attention not to the perfection, the purification that comes on the end, but he's also drawing as much attention to the process of purification, metaphorically to us as fiery trials. Yeah, it's going to feel like we're metal and being burned alive sometimes. It's not going to be very enjoyable. But the process of that allows us to be refined and purified. Going back, he says, though you have not seen him, you love him. He's telling him, how can you endure this? And so just as we haven't seen Jesus, yet we love him, this is one way to see the end of things. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and are filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy. Why do we feel that way? Because we have the example of Jesus and all that he was and all that he endured and all that he became because of setting his eyes on God above. And so from that, then he tells them, for you are receiving the end result of your faith, the salvation of your souls. Interesting way to say that. He doesn't say you're doing this so that one day, way out in the distance, you'll be able to receive your end reward. No, he says you are receiving the end result. This is a process. And if we don't see the fact that we are enduring and receiving some of the reward, the salvation of our souls now, as a reflection of our attitude of how we endure suffering and trials and afflictions and irrational circumstances that make no sense, if we don't understand that this is a process we enjoy and interact with now, then we are going to get caught up in all the negative, just as a side point out of all this. And how do you do that? Because you see and fix our eyes on Jesus. So knowing this, then, in all of these things, really summarized, I think, in this. Because some people lose heart as if God doesn't care. They'd like to say that God's some detached being way out there. He's just watching, not interacting, not caring. Jesus tells his disciples this in Matthew, the 10th chapter, beginning in verse 29. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny, yet not one of them will fall to the ground outside your Father's care? And even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You're worth more than many sparrows. Whoever acknowledges me before others, I will also acknowledge before my Father in heaven. And this is going to bring scorn and suffering and trials and hardships to achieve this. But know that God sees, cares, understands everything that we're dealing with. Because if he cares about just the simplest things of natural creation in the world around us, like sparrows, and he understands when even just one of them suffers and falls, and he says a simple truth, you're worth many, many more than sparrows, then what should that do for us? Should that give us the fuel, the energy, the understanding, the ability to see through hard things, and to be able to see that if we can stand before people now, knowing that God stands for, or excuse me, that Jesus stands before the Father acknowledging us, isn't that a reassuring thought? And shouldn't that, after all, be the mindset, the power, the energy that we use to get through this life? So that's the reason why I said being able to see the end, or in a more direct way, no pain, no gain. For us to be able to endure this life, to know where we're going, and see it through. The life that we lead can be rewarding. It can also be challenging. But first, you've got to want to commit your life towards Jesus himself. And that's the opportunity that you're going to have now in just a moment. So if you have not yet named Jesus, you have not yet been buried with him in baptism, we ask that you come now together as we stand.